Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. If you want to hear the extended version of this episode, please join the Patreon campaign. This week, I'm talking to Professor Philip J. Cozzolino about his work studying children's past life memories at the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. Hi, Philip. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Simon.
So you're working at the University of Virginia?
It's the Division of Perceptual Studies in the Department of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences in the School of Medicine at UVA.
What is your role there?
I am a research associate professor within the Division of Perceptual Studies. So basically 100% researcher, specifically trying to ask questions, test hypotheses regarding extraordinary human experience.
Is this something you've been interested in your whole life, or is it something that you've became interested in recently?
I spent 20 years as a mainstream, I don't really like that term, but as a non-parapsychological researcher in psychology. I worked for 17 years at the University of Essex in England. And most of that research that I did and that I have sort of been able to publish in peer-reviewed journals is influenced by the lessons from near-death experience research. So in what the experiencers told Bruce Grayson, Kenneth Ring, Raymond Moody, all these big names who studied near-death experiences. And basically in 2004, I published my first paper in a psychology journal saying, hey, look, there's this thing, near-death experiences and these experiencers and what we learn about how it can, that relationship with death influences them and changes their psychology, makes them, it comes with challenges, but it often leads to a growth and a sense of well-being that we don't often see in people, especially in terms of how long it lasts. It's not some sort of like New Year's resolution that just wanes. It seems to literally shift them into a almost like a different timeline, not literally, but in a sense. And as a psychologist, that was fascinating to me, because what you learn as a psychologist is that people are going to people, and they tend to, despite all of their awareness of what they're doing wrong or what could be better or how they could be better in their lives, they tend to just end up being who they are. And it can be frustrating. So these were people who I could see as a direct consequence of this awareness and confrontation and acceptance of mortality made them sort of become better over time. And I leveraged that into a model of how we could do that without having to have a near-death experience, how we could come to terms with our mortality. Now, the reason I tell that context is just to say, so this is what I've been doing for 20 years as a professional before even arriving at DOPS at UVA. And in 1978, when I was 9 years old, there was a documentary. This was only a few years after Raymond Moody even coined the phrase near-death experience. There was a documentary that came out in America. I don't know if it played anywhere else. It was called Beyond and Back. It was a documentary that played in the cinemas in America about near-death experiences. And I remember, so I was 9 years old in 1978. I remember saying to my mom, I want to go see this. Take me to this. And I have a clear memory of sitting in the cinema watching this documentary. And it's just really kind of something that I didn't think a lot about in those days when I was a young professional writing and doing this work about near-death experiences and leveraging lessons from that, until it sort of like came to me one night. I was like, oh my God, I've been interested in, like, I mean, I'm not saying I'm the only one, but I don't know a lot of 9-year-olds that just want to go see a near-death experience documentary, right? So it's just, so the very long-winded answer to your question with some context, I hope that's meaningful, is yes. for some reason, this is a topic that has motivated me and interested me from pretty much as early as I can remember.
And you got an interest in people's fear of death, didn't you?
Yeah, so that's, in a sense, that's the non-parapsychological approach that I took going back when early 2000s when I started re-educating, because I had a different career. I was in television as a writer and producer in broadcast news in Los Angeles. And I went back to school, got training, became a psychologist, got my PhD at University of Minnesota. And it was in that period when I was still a graduate student that I started wanting to engage in this conversation about mortality, fear of death, and more than fear of death, it's obviously they're connected, but they're not always connected, is the denial of death, the avoidance of death, the I don't want to confront it, accept it, contemplate it. And what I was learning, what I had already sort of come to, in a sense, organically, along with the reading that I was doing of near-death experiences and some other theories that existed in psychology, was just that that is not a healthy path for us. Fearing and denying our mortality is inevitably bad for humans, our psychology, our social experiences and relationships. And that, again, leveraging the near-death experience, literature, the lessons, also post-traumatic growth, similar, I could describe what that is if you need to, but basically people who have experienced life-altering, nearly dying instances, it could be from storms, like big cataclysmic storms, or it could be from horrendous things like Darfur and these kinds of like Rwanda, right? So anything that left someone shattered, their life completely upended, and at times afraid that they were going to die. And what you see in those literatures, both the near-death experiences, post-traumatic growth, is again, very difficult times, struggles, but over time, that confrontation, that awareness, acceptance, it becomes unavoidable. You can no longer deny your mortality. You've either experienced it or you have been around it so concretely that it's just now integrated into your life. And it's that integration of it that I took and basically brought to psychology and just tried to show that, you know, fear of death doesn't go away. It can be managed and it can be reduced. And part of that process has to be is an honest confrontation, not just the denying it. You can deny it and say, well, I don't fear it because I don't think about it. Well, that's not the same thing as saying I fear it less than I used to because I think about it and I am actively engaged in how I live, right? The fear of death prevents us from fully living. And if we confront that fear and take on the reality that we all face and we use that and we get energy from that, it can generate outcomes for us that are actually much more beneficial than what we were, the track we were on, including reducing our fear of death, but more than that.
And how does having a near-death experience or having knowledge of near-death experiences affect that?
Yeah, for the experiencers, it's profound, right? It is, I was just at, with most of my colleagues from DOPS, we were at the big international association of near-death studies, the IANS conference in Chicago just a few weeks ago. And it's unlike a lot of research conferences, it's almost, I mean, there are researchers like myself and my colleagues, but the majority of the folks there are experiencers. And you go to these talks and you meet people in small settings who have had these experiences. And this is, for them, it is multifaceted. It is the death is no longer abstract. It is no longer a concept. It is something they have experienced. They, again, I'm going to take the approach as a good researcher and my colleague, Dr. Bruce Grayson would take, and Marietta Pilvanova, my other colleague, we study this together. You know, there, you know, I'm leaning toward the fact because there doesn't seem to be a very clear biological, physical, materialistic explanation for some of these accounts, especially the vertical ones where people come back with information they shouldn't have. But at the same time, I don't know quite what's happening yet. I will tell you that they know, they believe they know what's happened. And so for them, the experiencer, it is life-altering. It is course-changing. It is 180 degrees often. And it is just something that they inherently know that they're going to be okay and that death is a natural part of this process. And that, again, whether or not they were in some other realm speaking to a former entity, a former family member or not. What mattered to me was, okay, these are folks who are no longer afraid to talk about death. They are no longer denying it. They are not seeking it. They're wanting to live more fully than ever before. And that's the point that struck me. And what I've tried to say is, now I haven't necessarily, I've done a little bit of this sort of like exposing non-experiencers to a near-death experience account or narratives, and that has some power, and we are actually pursuing that. I've just put together a grant proposal to do that, so to expose people to these powerful narratives. But what I did is I kind of took a different approach. In my work, I basically took some of the key elements that come out of near-death experiences. So a confrontation with death that you can't avoid. It happens, right? It's just there. You died or you think you died. What's known as a life review. This is a very common feature in near-death experiencers where they will describe in sort of instantaneously a multi-angled reflection and sort of revisiting of all of, if not most of, the most important elements of their and moments of their lives. Also, not just from their own perspective, but from perspectives from people with whom they were interacting. So if they hurt someone, they would take that person's perspective. If they helped someone, they would take that person's perspective. And it's all just sort of happening in this sort of hard to describe sequence of time and instantaneously experiencing it. Part of what happens as well is this perspective taking is part of that life review. So what I built was basically what we call in social psychology, experimental psychology, a manipulation that you would use in an experimental lab where you basically ask people in one condition to read a scenario, imagine themselves experience something where by the end of it, they have died. It's unavoidable. There was nothing they could do. No one was to blame. And then after that, I asked a series of before open-ended questions that basically tried to leverage those things, asked about the life review, talk about the life that you've lived up to this point, if that did happen to you, talk about the people with whom you've interacted in your life. So there's the perspective taking. There's also the basically a question that asks just to kind of reflect on how did this reading this and thinking about this end of your life experience or imagined scenario make you feel. And there are some other manipulations that people had been using in psychology that basically showed anytime you get people to think about death, bad things happen. I'm generalizing, but that's kind of the truth. It leads to fear and denial and bias and bad behavior and bad outcomes. And what I was able to show is that if you put people through that condition, as opposed to the other more common condition and a control condition, which was just having them think about nothing that had to do with dying, I could reflect in certain studies what we were seeing in near-death experiencers, people who were becoming less biased, more inclusive, less greedy, whereas in the other condition, they were taking more because it was the classic way of, you know, fear and denial. And you saw the bad behavior that you would predict. And I was able to generate evidence in the lab that said, you know, you don't have to have a near-death experience to start thinking about your life differently. You can actually engage in a process that these experiencers are engaging in. Now, the crux is you do need to kind of contemplate a death. You need to think like, I could die this way. I imagine that could have happened to me, like a real experiencer. But then you need to do more than that. You need to actually dig into, what do I think about the life I've lived at this point? How have I been to others in my life? And what would they think of this if it happened? And once you start doing some of that, again, it's subtle. I called it a subtle manipulation. It's not a near-death experience. But I was just trying to demonstrate that our psychology is malleable. And at that time, and to some extent still today, the dominant thinking in psychology is that if you get humans to think about death, it leads pretty much to bad. And I was convinced that that wasn't the whole truth. I think it's part of the truth. It just depends how you think about death, or in a sense, how you don't think about death, right? If you try to avoid it, if you try to deny it, if you continually let the fear guide you, and if you can kind of own your own human experience and overcome those fears, it pays off for you in the end.
Have you done a lot of research into children's past life memories of where you are now at the university?
Other than a little bit within NDEs, the near-death experiences, and I still do with my colleague, Marietta, Dr. Bruce Grayson. That's pretty much my main focus there. I arrived at DOPS in January of 2024 and was brought in to work pretty much exclusively with Dr. Jim Tucker, who was retiring and has since retired a year later, 12 months later in December of 2024. And now Marietta and myself have kind of taken up that leg of the research. So it started in an essay on 44 cases in 1960 by Dr. Ian Stevenson. Eventually went to Emily Kelly and Jim Tucker, and now it's Marietta and myself. Now that's at DOPS. There are people around the world, other researchers who study it as well. A handful, not many. But at DOPS, yes, that's my main focus. And I had a lot of, you know, learning to do because I had spent the bulk of my research and learning pre all those 20 years where I was a psychologist, not really focused on the children's purportedly recalling past lives. It was near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences that, of course, are sort of like near-death experiences. That's what I've been doing for the last nearly 2 years. And we've got a couple papers out and some in press now. And we've got a huge, well, it's huge for our field. We've got Marietta, my colleague, and I have a two-year grant for €500,000 that we've brought in to bring the research into a new direction. And again, for people who study cancer or autism or whatever, €500,000 isn't all that much. But for this work, it's a fair bit of money to get in a grant. So we're very excited about the future of that work, and I'd be happy to talk about it.
Do you feel that what you've learned and what is coming through from these children is enough for you to prove reincarnation? Or do you say it's very suggestive?
Well, I would never say that, and this isn't trying to be clever or avoidant. I would never in anything say that I could prove anything. I think that's just not the way that a researcher or a scientist should work. I think the best you can ever do is come to a conclusion, and that is, of all the explanations, this is my preferred one. And you are free to have a different one if you want. But it'd be good if you collected your own data and didn't just debunk my preference and my explanation. So I don't try to prove anything. I don't think you can prove anything. I mean, to this story I kind of tell is, like, even to this day in psychology, one of the most dominant ideas in psychology is something no doubt you and the listeners have heard of before, cognitive dissonance, from Festinger. And I mean, this is an old school idea. Everyone, they use the term now. People, oh, I'm experiencing cognitive dissonance. To this day, there are psychologists who argue with each other about, is it a thing? Is it this? Is maybe it's really that? So, you know, if you can't agree on the process, rightfully so, after, you know, 80, 90 years of study in the field, then, you know, don't expect people to be able to come to some meaningful conclusion on near-death experiences and reincarnation. What I have come to is, and how I approach the work, and as we do at DOPS in general, is I approach the work with an open mind and a willingness to explore all potential reasonable, testable hypotheses, and a willingness to come to a preferred explanation that is perhaps extraordinary or challenging to the mainstream sort of physicalist approach to science, that everything is occurring in the brain and there is no such thing as consciousness other than what's occurring in dendrites and, you know, et cetera. So when it comes to these children with past life, what appear to be past life memories, I think my answer that I can give you, again, and I apologize for the long-winded response, is it's a thing. I don't know what the thing is, but it's a thing. And what I mean by that is, so we just talked about how I've spent most of my professional career studying the human relationship to death. And what you learn early on as a student of that is that roughly around the age of four-ish, five, I mean, it's obviously, you know, it's not a guarantee, but around that age, a child will start kind of, hey, what happened to our puppy? Or where is grandma, right? And when will I see them again? And, oh, I see they're in heaven, right? So they get told stories that from the worldviews that's where all that starts happening. But the questions are like, they don't understand. They try to construe it in a way that it's just, so they're on vacation. Oh, they're with Jesus, or they're with my other grandmother now. And when will I see them again? These kinds of statements, very classic sort of young 4 or 5 year old trying to make sense of death. And that is just not what we, like the cases that we have, and there are nearly 2,300 of them that have been investigated by DOPS researchers over the 60 plus years. These are 2.5-year-olds, 3-year-olds saying, I'm paraphrasing, it's not always this, but it's like this, you know, mommy, when I died in that car crash, I was sad to leave my children behind. And the parents will just snap their head and be like, what are you saying? And this is such a common, like a 2.5 or 3-year-old saying, well, when I fought in that war and died, that's just not how kids talk about death. Like it's not even asking about that. They're explaining their experience with death, oftentimes untriggered, most times spontaneously. And like I said, I don't yet know what this is. And I wouldn't be comfortable saying I have determined it is X, Y, or Z, or Z. But it is a qualitatively different thing, right? It isn't kids with imaginary friends. It is a child telling stories, sometimes very specific details that come out. We have a case right now we're studying where one of the first things this 2.5, 3-year-old child said to their parents is, when I was this person, first name, last name, this was my job, and I liked pizza. And it turns out that this person isn't a famous person. Most people, most of these cases, they don't claim to be anyone famous. They're just normal people. This person actually existed. And the job that the child listed, I'm being vague for just anonymity reasons at this point, but the job that the child said is exactly what the person did. And this, I liked pizza, links to a place in this country where they lived, where they're known for pizza. Again, just one, you know, and there was other stuff and that was identifiable and verifiable. And again, it's just, I don't know how to explain these kinds of consequences, these kinds of outcomes, these kinds of statements, these kinds of behaviors in a way that is, I know what it is. What I do know is it is unique. It is qualitatively a phenomenon that is, I think, its own thing, different from what you would normally experience in children. And the children are different. There is evidence, and we're collecting data ourselves, but there's already published evidence. They are significantly more intelligent. They're significantly more verbal. They have significantly better memories in general than children their age. So they are unique. It just sort of inherently, but there's obviously this component of them telling these stories about who they claim to have once been that at times, I mean, there are, you know, nearly 2,300 cases investigated in our database. 70% of those have actually provided enough information that there has been an identification made of someone who lived a previous life that matches the details above chance from what this 2, 3, 4-year-old was saying of who they once were. So again, how do I explain that? It's remarkable and it's worth pursuing, I think, as a researcher.
And that's great. You get all that information that can be confirmed, but there's also physical stuff, isn't there? Birthmarks and birth deformities.
Yeah, so that was one of Ian's big, he wrote 2 huge volumes. We have them in the library where I work every day. Massive, thick books on this, basically demonstrating and connecting, oftentimes absolutely verifying that. So this, you know, we have pictures in the library of children who are missing fingers. They were born that way, or they'll have birth. So that's a defect. They'll have birthmarks where there's a birthmark in one child that on the back left of his skull. There's no other way to describe it. Like once you shave the boy's head, you'll see this birthmark that looks like an axe hit or a machete hit, right? That like that's kind of what it would look like, this scar of something like that. And in both of those cases, the missing hands or fingers and the machete axe hit, Ian was able to verify that with enough detail from what the boy was telling that someone in the family and the boy didn't know in a different location in the world matched the story. And in fact, with postmortem reports, could say, yes, this person died with a machete hit to the back left of their head. And this person, while they were being killed, had their hands cut off. So I think the birthmark, birth defect thing, I don't mean to laugh because it's tragic. I chuckle at it because we debate all the time amongst ourselves, amongst fellow scholars, amongst people who are skeptics about like, well, what is this? Why is this? And why couldn't it just be imagination? Or couldn't it even be something remarkable, but not reincarnation? Something like a Akashic record, they call it, like a super psi, where these kids are just somehow able to connect to information about a past life. They're not reincarnated. There's just somehow it still would be remarkable, but it's still an attempt to say it's not reincarnation. And all of that is interesting. But then you get to the thing of the birthmarks and you're like, yeah, but what about the birthmarks? Like that, I don't know how having psychic access to information that exists in the universe or as consciousness exists outside of the physical realm, how that would then implant physically into a new child or a new incarnation. Again, this is all speculation. This is just the kind of things that you start eventually thinking, well, why would this? And what is the natural explanation? Now, obviously a natural explanation could be simple, right? Where someone could be born with birthmarks that look, you know, the dots on their chest. And someone at some point when the 3 or 4 year old goes, looks like he got shot with bullets. And then the kid starts telling a story about how I died being shot by bullets. And so clearly some of that is a part of this. But like I said, a number of these cases, upwards of 15 to 20% of them, researchers at Dobbs have been able to verify with postmortem reports unidentified past persons that is in fact seemingly a mark that would have been left on that body in some tragic, often traumatic, fatal incident that led to that person's death. And so it can't just be suggestion, right? That's part of the confusion. We also have evidence. I've got a paper in press right now that's peer-reviewed journal about language has transferred. We have a feature in the database called xenoglossy. Now, people may not know this term, but xenoglossy is a process. It's a phenomenon that some people don't think is real, but it's the classic sort of this person started speaking a foreign language out of the blue. They don't know it. They've never been exposed to it. And suddenly they were speaking it. And we have nearly 2,300 cases, and we had 40 cases. It's not a ton of cases, but 40 of the children in our database were documented by the investigators through their investigation over many decades across the countries. There's 40 of them. Having spoken a language that everyone that knew the child, the family, the teachers, anyone they could investigate and interview would say, yeah, they don't speak the language here. No one here speaks that language. And yet all those 40 cases, of course, were speaking a language tied to, they said they were from this country and that was the language that they were speaking as a child. Sometimes it's just words. Sometimes it was full sentences. And what I did is I said, okay, so if this is fraud, if this is misinterpretation, if this is just pure chance, well, then these 40 cases through the database should have, over the 60 years of doing this, should just be randomly distributed, right? There should be no coherent, systematic relationship between them being these bizarrely, allegedly speaking the foreign language that they shouldn't know cases relating to anything meaningful in the database. So what I did is I leveraged the birthmarks, which is trauma and emotion, because that's our best prediction is like, well, if this is connected to a previous person, maybe there's something about the trauma of it, the unexpectedness of it, the emotion attached to it that somehow transferred these marks forward, if you will. Again, speculative. And what I found in the database was these 40 cases, I predicted on some meaningful variables and some simple explanations, like their level of intelligence, the age at which they first started speaking in their normal language. Maybe they're just more verbal. Maybe they heard someone on the radio and they just picked up something. And none of the normal explanations could explain it. And the only significant predictors of what made these 40 kids different from the kids who weren't speaking a foreign language was the experience of a traumatic death they claimed in the past life and the intense experience of emotion that the memories caused in them. So again, I get back to what I said earlier with, I don't know what it is, but I know it's a thing, because yeah, it could just be chance, but it's just, to me, chance is an outcome that you find when you do statistical analyses. And when you predict something theoretically that says, well, it could be nothing, but if it is something, it would look like this. And then you do the analyses and it looks like that. You start thinking, well, how is it that I would assume that trauma and emotion like birthmarks might have something to do with transferring the language forward from the past life? And in fact, it's the only thing that predicts it. On data that have been collected for 60 years by multiple investigators in multiple countries, right? This isn't a collusion to tell this story. This is an ongoing investigation over time, over culture, over era. And yet the best predictor of what we think might be happening seems to be the explanation for it, just like with the birthmarks. So again, long answer. I apologize for that. But I just keep coming back to, that's what tells me something is here. What it is, I don't know. But if you keep testing your hypotheses and you keep finding relationships that make sense, you just, as a researcher, you want to keep testing, you want to keep asking, you want to keep searching.
Hello, this is me, Simon. Did you know that during a past life regression, you can meet with your spirit guide? I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom, and I've guided many clients to a spiritual encounter with their guide. If you would like to ask me how a session would work for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. I think sometimes you get the impression, or I do, is that when the children talk about their past life memories, they might just be happily playing on the floor with toys and mention something. But actually, it's a lot more emotional than that, isn't it? A lot more intense.
It can be for a number of them. Obviously, there are some who it's sometimes incredibly matter of fact. We have a case that we've talked with recently with a mother who says, it's so funny, we'll be walking through the park and she'll be like, oh, look at the dog, mommy. You know, when I was a paramedic, I used to save people's lives with CPR. And then she'll go, oh, I want to go on the swing. So it's just like, sometimes it's just like, what has happened? Like, where did that come from and why? And then, of course, yes, there definitely are cases, some famous ones like James Leininger and others, where the memories are horrific and traumatic. I mean, we're talking about deaths that they're remembering, allegedly, with limbs being cut off or being hit in the head with an axe, or James Leininger, the famous American case, being shot down in a fiery plane crash near Iwo Jima in World War II. And, you know, he would wake up in the middle of the night with nightmares, screaming about fire, little man on fire. And that's, you know, it's horrendous. It's just horrific. And part of what the very first paper I published at DOMS, which is in press now, it's taken a while for the journal to do it. It was accepted a while back. Is a paper on the parents. We only have a few meaningful variables of the parent experience of this. And I felt like I want to dig in there because I think I don't have a child. I'm not a parent, but I can't imagine what it must be like to be a parent and have a 2-3-year-old, 4-year-old who is telling you these stories about how they died and oftentimes emotionally scared, lots of phobias in our database that are connected. So a child who tells you a story about how they drowned, can't get the child near the bathtub or the sink to wash them as a baby even before they were verbal, they would respond negatively to water. I mean, these parents, and then when you add on top of that, it's a layered process because it's not just my child who's in distress, it's also who do I go to? Right. As a parent, who do I tell that my child is claiming they once died in a fiery plane crash and I don't know what to do and I'm concerned for them, but no one will listen to me because they'll think I'm crazy. Right. So as a parent, this is just on multiple levels. It is challenging. And even though at DOPS, we're not counselors, we're not family practitioners. One of our key goals, one of our main areas of focus is normalizing this. Again, not saying we're publishing more and more in journals that are just psychiatric journals, not parapsychology journals. And, you know, we're not saying, hey, everyone, this is reincarnation, get used to it. We're saying, hey, guys, kind of what I've been saying, this is a thing. It's real. And that real meaning, it's a phenomenon that's happening to kids and families. And these people need to go somewhere. They need to be able to talk to someone about this, because no matter what it is, this is a child in a family, often, not always, but often in distress. At the very least, they're confused and unsure of how to move forward. This isn't in the Dr. Spock books, right? This isn't in How to Raise a Child. So when they start talking about a past life, you do this. And that's our focus right now, is in addition to trying to understand and to conceptualize ideas of consciousness and possibilities of surviving, you know, consciousness surviving bodily death. That's all great and fun and sexy stuff, and I love being there. We're also interested in trying to just tell the world that these people need assistance. It's nothing wrong. In fact, we just published a paper that showed 36 years after, about 35, I can't remember, it was 30-some kids who are now adults. They were investigated by Ian Stevenson about 36 years prior on average. And we were able to publish a paper in a psychology journal saying, yeah, okay, it's this phenomenon that you may not have heard of. It's kind of wild. And we just wanted to check in with them and see how they're doing. And it turns out they're fine. They're not really that much different from what you'd expect from adults their age. So there isn't, it isn't a bad, like, it isn't something to diagnose and pathologize, but it is a, it's an experience they're having. And they're going to need assistance. They're going to need someone to talk to. And they don't know who to go to. They'll often tell us, they'll just say out loud at some point, I just, thank you so much for listening to me, because I don't know who else would. I haven't been able to go to my priest or my doctor or my family, because they'll think I'm crazy. And I'll throw this little nugget out there that connects to this. We're about to start writing a paper. We've got the data in. We did 1,000 mothers in America. So it's American-focused, representative, nationally representative sample as best you could, because we had to focus on mothers with children between certain ages. And then it's weighted to try to be as close to a representative sample as you can get. But these are just random moms just in the country. And we, after 60 years of doing this, obviously as a division, not myself or my colleague Marietta, but we, Marietta and I, have been able to come up with a list of like 11 behaviors and statements that are the classic kinds of things that you would see from these children. Because again, it is a thing. It's a unique, qualitatively different thing. So we know what that looks like. And then we had some other measurements as well that were meaningful for us. But these 11 statements or behaviors, like we've been talking about, how I, has your child ever talked about how before this life they had once died, or they once had a different family, or how you aren't their first mommy, all these kinds of very classic statements and behaviors that we see. And there's 11 of them. And preliminarily, I don't want to, you know, we'll see. We haven't done it full analysis yet, but the preliminary analysis on what will be this paper shows us that as many as mothers who endorsed 3 or more of those 11 classic past life memory behavior statements, 3 or more, is 7%. So even though there are, I don't know if that number will hold. Even if it's 6, it could be 8. I don't know what it will be when we do the full final analysis. But if it's even remotely close to 7%, to me, that's astounding. Again, it doesn't mean that these are reincarnation cases. It means that these are, this is a random sample of 1,000 mothers, and 3 or more of these statements would be weird to get, right? Unusual to get from children. How they died, jobs they used to have, kids they used to have, et cetera, all these kinds of classic statements. And to get 7% of mothers to say, yeah, my child said yes to 3 or more of those, had said those things, to me tells me this is not as anomalous as it might appear, that this is a phenomenon that's happening. And it's, and if it is 7%, it's an undercount, right? Because this is just the 7% of moms who remembered and who listened and were able to say yes to our questions randomly, because no doubt some child has said to their mom, you know, mom, when I used to be a doctor, and the kids, they were like, yeah, great, let's go. We got to go to soccer, right? Like, at some point, like, how many kids might be saying these things and it's just not being clocked? It's not being given attention or even heard. So if 7% of these moms were able to remember these statements and tell us about it, it probably is more than that.
Yeah, I was in the kitchen years ago, my daughter was 3, she just said to me, you know, I used to pick you up when you were this small. And that's the only thing she ever said, but I always remembered that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a common one where they talk about how when they were parents, and sometimes it is phrased in that way, like that they were the parent to you, right? Exactly. And, you know, it could be that maybe they were thinking, you know, there would be some argument that maybe they are remembering a related member of the family, like your grandmother or something to that extent. But if it doesn't come more than that one statement, then it's sometimes it's just a kid saying things, but you'd want to try and, you know, figure out like, well, where is that coming from without prodding? You just sort of take note and listen and just see if anything else came. But for you, it was the one off and who knows?
There's a thing called intermission memories with children who remember their past lives. So if you can kind of validate the things they're saying about the past life, what does that have to say about the intermission memories?
Yeah, so the intermission period, the intermission memories are interesting to us because I, myself and Marietta are interested in them. Inherently, they're interesting. This is, so to be clear, this is some percentage. It's not a huge percentage, but, and I don't know it offhand, but it's not nothing of our cases, our 2,300 cases. Don't just talk about when they were John in that country who died in an accident. They will actually talk about the period between John's death and their birth into this life. So where they were, what they experienced in that intermission is the term that Ian called it, sort of the between lives period. And what's interesting to us mostly about that is, remember, there's something I want to be very clear about, because even in this context, it gets tricky. These are kids. These are two and a half, three, four. Verbal skills are higher, better than on average, like I said, but they're still kids. You know, they don't know, they're not right. You know, near-death experiencers will talk about their experience as adults with a full vocabulary, and it's really quite rich. So sometimes what you get from these intermission memories are really a sentence or two, like very quick little statements. Like one that we like is, a kid, I can't remember from where, but it was somewhere overseas a few decades back, maybe many decades back, saying, I remember following my mommy to the watering hole on a number of occasions. It was a kid's sentence, but basically the story was, I followed her to this watering hole to make sure, and then decided that, yes, and then dropped myself as a speck of dust into her bucket of water so that she could drink me and then I would be her child. So it's like often it's poetic. It's almost like from these children, the stories are more poetic, whereas the adults with a near-death experience are really desperately trying. They'll often say it's ineffable. I don't have the words for it. That's almost the most common thing they say. But they are really trying to explain their experience in this other space that they think they were in. From their perspective. The kids are much more like, I picked my mommy out of a basket of mommies. But this is the point I want to make. One of the things that's most interesting to Marietta and myself about these intermission memories is, separate from the past life memory research we're doing, because again, what we're trying to do at Dobbs is we have these different sort of, they appear like silos. There's the past life memory research, there's the near-death experience research, there's the out-of-body experience, there's the after-death communication research, there's the psychic experience research. But we are trying to connect them all, because at some point, if consciousness is a thing, if it is fundamentally the core of who we are, not a byproduct of neurons and dendrites, well, there's going to be some, these areas that we're studying are going to have idiosyncratic elements, because a person dying of a car crash who's an adult in India is going to have their own cultural expectations and filters that go into their narratives, that it's going to be different from a four-year-old American boy who's telling a story of a past life, and et cetera. All these things are going to have idiosyncratic elements, but there's going to be a core overlap. We're going to find some overlap if we look hard enough and if we do this job well. And that overlap might be the most important point to be focused on in terms of what is this thing that's happening if it is a consciousness as fundamental approach. And why I'm saying all this is, what's fascinating to us is, one of the things you read, it pops out at you when you read near-death experience narratives. It isn't 100% of experiencers, but it is very common for a near-death experiencer to say, it became clear to me, it became known to me, I was told, I was reminded, all these different ways they'll say it, that I had chosen this life. I had chosen this path that I'm on right now, which speaks to autonomy. And what's interesting is many of these children's intermission periods, I had, you know, basket of mommies floated down and like a speck of dust in the butt. I'm not paying attention to that. What I'm paying attention to is both of those examples are themes of what? Choice. I chose this mommy out of that basket of mommies. I decided to enter that bucket as a speck of dust. What is that? Autonomy, right? So what strikes me is consciousness. I'm coming to this conclusion speculatively as we engage in these fun conversations about what if consciousness is a thing and it survives bodily death and it is the underlying feature of all that we are and that we perceive. Well, it's starting to become a safe hypothesis that consciousness is autonomous, that at some point it chooses and it's free to do so. And near-death experiencers will say that. Yeah, 100%. I remember very clearly having a choice. Do I want this life or not? I didn't have to do it. It wasn't forced on me. I wanted to come back and live another life. I wanted to have this experience that I'm having now, knowing full well that there were potential outcomes that could be bad or good. And to me, that's fascinating, especially because this physical realm that we're in, this materialistic plane, isn't amenable to autonomy. It really isn't. It is incredibly restrictive. It is incredibly deterministic. I'm starting to think like that's, I sometimes annoy my colleagues by saying, you know, I think that I'm coming to this conclusion that the reason human beings have been arguing about, do we have free will? Am I agentic? Do I have autonomy or not? And people have been bristling in certain cultures for years against restrictions of autonomy and is because at some level, maybe at our core consciousness level, we are purely autonomous. And the only reason we're even asking the question and having the debate is because suddenly at some core level, we know this isn't how this is supposed to be. This is uncomfortable. This feels quite restricting. And yet at the same time, the beauty of that story, if you want to just go for the speculative ride, is that you took the ride knowing full well that you were giving some of that up, right? That the whole purpose of saying that you hear these near-death experiencers talk is saying, well, I chose it. And I knew going in that meant I wasn't going to be the free spirit consciousness that I am now, because we know what the rules are on this plane and they are restrictive and they are challenging. But that's part of the learning process of what you deal with here is that's the human experience. So I know this is really out there and it's really abstract. And again, I'm not saying that's what's happening. I'm saying it's fun to speculate. And what allows me to speculate is that overlap. Past life memory children at 3 or 4 talking about autonomously choosing, and near-death experiencers who haven't ever had a past life memory saying, oh, I know, I became clear to me that I chose this life, this exact life that I'm living now, I chose it. And I don't know how you'd throw those two things out as chance. It just seems like, okay, there's an overlap that we need to focus on.
Do you see a common pattern in children related to their past lives that might indicate why they remember their past lives?
Mm. That's a really good question. I will tell you that we don't quite know the answer. We have some hypotheses, which is what we're trying to do. The grant I mentioned earlier that Marietta Pilipinova and I received, these €500,000, the sort of motivating question at the top of our proposal that we submitted to the agencies that gave us the money, the question is, why these children? What is it about these children that is leading to these experiences, these purported memories? What is it unique? Is there something unique about them? Inherently them, but also potentially about the memories that they're discussing. It's difficult. We have a dual pathway hypothesis. It's a little bit wonky. But our best guess at this point that we're testing, that's what this study is, right? Whereas this grant, why I said earlier, it's sort of a novel approach, not just getting the money was kind of unheard of, but also it's everything historically has basically been case studies. So a case comes up in India or in America or, you know, wherever, and I go and we investigate and then we investigate again and then we figure out something, we get new information and then we chase that down, right? That's what these researchers are doing. And then they report the study of James Leininger or Ryan Hammonds or any of the people that we, and then we, of course, have aggregated them into this big database that we have, but they were all just individual case studies. This isn't that. This is going to be the first attempt to try to bring children into, in a sense, the lab. Sometimes we have to bring the lab equipment to them to test them in the context of trauma and emotion, which is one of the pathways. We talked about it earlier, the birthmarks, the xenoglossy. There seems to be something about that that is... So the best way I can describe that, just to make it clear in a data sense, is in our database of roughly 2,300 cases, 63% of them have talked about how they died. But of that 63%, 75% have described a traumatic, unnatural death. So clearly, there's something about trauma here that is linked to why these kids are remembering. Now, what's interesting is it doesn't seem that they've experienced trauma in this life. So again, I'm not sure why it may be. Again, if we're going to speculate that this is something connected to a past life, maybe that traumatic process, the unexpectedness, right? Maybe there's something about how that consciousness needed to continue moving on this plane and just said, I got to go. And somehow, again, pure speculation, just for the fun of it. I have no idea. I'm just trying to make sense of this in the context of if it is something like a reincarnation process. The trauma thing is there. It's not a biased part of the database, I don't believe. It really isn't. We have data that suggests the unexpected nature, verified unexpected nature of the previous person's death predicts shorter intermission periods, right? So, which is not something a child could fake. It's not something like a child is born and then they start telling a story and then verified later, we find a case that matches what they're saying and we figure out and we can verify that in fact, that death was an unexpected, often traumatic death. And those cases are significantly faster to have reincarnated, if you want to use that term, than cases that didn't have unexpected traumatic deaths. There's something that's not, a child couldn't, it's just two things occurred in space and time, and there is a systematic relationship. There's something there, maybe. I don't know, but it's worth pursuing. The other pathway is we just think these kids might, we have good links to what we mentioned earlier, that we know they're more intelligent for their age. We know they're more verbal for their age. Both of those things probably we know in the literature should predict that they just have better memories. So they just make their, in this incarnation, in this life, they just may have better memory processes. And we think we know already they likely do. We're going to test it a little bit more robustly. That's been tested in the past. And that's autobiographical memory, not just like, so of their own existence, of their own life right now. And we're going to be bringing kids into the lab, control kids, past life memory kids. And we're going to test that and say, are these children actually, do they have better memory processes than others? And one of the things I'm interested in is when you go down that road of studying memory in children, there's a great researcher, her last name is Bauer. She's done a lot of work on memory in children, not in past life memories, just memory in children. And she talks about in one or a couple of her papers, something that's really fascinating to me in this context of these past life memories is she speaks about memory. We often think of it as, she says, in this positive way, meaning not positive, negative, meaning good or bad, but just meaning like, oh, information came in, I encoded it, and now I've retrieved it. That's what we think of as memory, right? Like, oh, I can pull it out. There it is. I have this memory. But there's another part of it that she kind of refers to more as like a negative process. Again, not bad, just which is the forgetting process. It is its own unique thing, how we come to forget and how easy it is to forget things. And there are specific ways that you can test that and explore that in the lab. And I think that could be a part of this too. It may be that the kids do have better memory, sort of positive memory, maybe better to encode and retrieve. But it may also be that these PLM kids, these past life memory kids, are that their forgetting processes are not as active and are, in a sense, thwarted compared to other kids. And because they clearly, if again, you want to speculate that this is a memory from a past life, they're not forgetting it. Right. So maybe this a combination of whatever happened to this consciousness before, whoever this biological being is now. Again, it's speculative. I wish I had a better answer for you. But like most researchers answering questions about just about anything, it's an ongoing process.
It's been great having you on the podcast. I love talking to you about all this stuff. Do you have a website?
No, Simon, I don't. I mean, other than the UVA DOPS, the University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies, you can certainly visit me and all of the researchers there. We all have a page there just describing who we are, and you'll see who we are. I do want to, you know, it's important, I hope, for the listeners to understand that, like, I talk about trying to normalize these experiences for the experiencers, but I also want, I think it's important to normalize the people doing the work, right? Understand that, like, I know some of this stuff, obviously your listeners are going to be locked in, and some people will think, wow, that's kind of out there. I don't know what this person's talking about. I don't know what the range of listening is, but it's probably all of that. And all I want people to understand is come visit the website, look at who we are. We've got, you know, I've PhD from the University of Minnesota. I've worked for 20 years in University of Essex in England with colleagues who got their PhDs at University of Pennsylvania and did postdocs at UCLA. And I mean, we're like, you know, I'm not boasting. There are better scholars, but we're good scholars. We're trained. We're trying to do this the right way. We are struggling because there's like five of us, you know, at the core. We have help. We have Elliot. We have some others who are research assistants and specialists and such. We don't get grant money the way that most people get grant money. We're almost 98-99% funded by private donations. It's a challenge to do this work, and we're trying our best. It'd be so much easier to just be, you know, say, here we have truth, believe us. And it's just, we want to do it the right way because it's the way it should be done and the way we're trained to do it. And I hope if you visit the website, you'll check out all our publications are online there. You can read things that we've done. We do appear on podcasts. We're very open about who we are and how we work. Reach out if you have stories. If you're an experiencer, contact the DOPS email address that you'll find there. Let us know. There's a questionnaire that you could take that is sort of a triage that we do to eventually potentially contact folks. And I just thank you, Simon, for having me on and for, you know, allowing this kind of conversation to happen. I think it's important. And I do think it's a conversation that more and more people are open to than they were, you know, not that long ago. Just recently, a colleague of mine was asked by an interviewer, where do you see this field going in 10 years from now? Where would you see it being 10 years from now? And she, my colleague, didn't say this, but I said, God, I would have said, I don't know, but I know 10 years ago, you wouldn't even have asked me that question, right? So it's like, it's beautiful to see science and people outside of science who are engaged in research and interested in it are open to this more so than ever before. And I just hope that maybe we can keep doing this work for as long as possible, because it's some of the most exciting work I've ever done.
Again, thanks for coming on the podcast. It's been great.
Thank you for having me, Simon.
This week, I was talking to Professor Philip Cozzolino about his work studying children's past life memories at the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. If you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, you can sign up to Patreon. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife. Or click on the Patreon button on my homepage, pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. My book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, is out on Amazon, and you can get it on audiobook, paperback, or on Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.